Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. So partly just because it's fun for me to do, and partly because I haven't done it for quite a while, welcome to the Talky Bit. We've just been having these rich conversations with one another about the things that are going on in our lives and the things that matter to us. I know I've said it before, let me say it again. I would not trade those conversations for anything programmatic. I think they are the heartbeat of a community, and they're easily displaced, actually, with things that have to go a certain way at a certain time. There's not something wrong with that, but I think sometimes, and we'll touch on this in a moment, sometimes there's a pragmatism about that and a comfort about the control of that that, again, can matter in a positive way, and also it can just get in the way. And so I feel like our, if there's a balance that we go back and forth between, we've been richly in the space of the interpersonal, a number of our gatherings, and what a delight to be in a place where we can do that. I'm so pleased that that's part of our life together. When we have been in this sort of talky bit space, I was sort of chuckling when I hit send this week because it was the same title. I think that it's been for 3 weeks or so, which is fine. You all know that I have this not hidden propensity to say I'm going to talk about thing X next week, and then it takes 4 weeks to talk about it. In a row, not to get to it, but to just unfold it. This is not the case for this one so much. It's more just that we're coming back to it. But we've been talking about changing beliefs. And one of the things that we talked about a few weeks ago was factors that influence belief change. Why do our beliefs tend to change? So, and this has sort of popped up in our community time this morning as well, in what you shared, James. This, you know, a friend who's like exploring what they believe and looking at other shapes of the general realm of Christian belief in this case, and going, what about those Christians over there and the way they do this thing called Christian belief and faith? And your journey has taken you certainly into a number of different elements of that, but also well beyond that in many ways. And same thing would be true for many of us in the room. There's lots of factors that get us moving on the path of changing belief, and they're not all conscious. We're going to get to the how to change your beliefs because you want to part today. But that's not the way it always happens, is it? Sometimes our beliefs change because of things that happen to us. And we're just traveling along and we're realizing, I don't even know if I believe that. I haven't thought about whether I believe that anymore for quite some time. So maybe it's not relevant, or maybe it, and so on. And then the questions can spool up from there. But there are lots of things that can impact that. So a quick review, just because we haven't all been in on it, new information and experiences is high on the list. Because lots of times what we believe is the way we navigate an experience, right? That's how we make meaning of what we're experiencing. It's how we frame it, how we have some semblance of how the world works as we experience it and understand it. And when we get new information or experiences that challenge those beliefs or those frameworks, they can really knock us off the track we were on. And sometimes that's a good knock, and sometimes it's a really alarming one, but either way, it can change the direction of what we believe. Changing environments, as distinct from new information and experiences. We can have new information and experiences in familiar environments, but we can also have things that change around us. right? And so I think about, for example, a couple of sort of easily visible writ large examples of this in the last few years would be a global pandemic. And let's say a freedom convoy, for example, more local, right? A little closer to home than a global thing. Things that we can be in, we can still be in the environment we're in, and then something changes that environment in a way that we're like, okay, I have to reconsider. This is challenging, something that I believe. Social influence, and I'm not just talking about the socials here, just society more writ large. When society changes around us, one of the big categories of raw material that we work with when we make beliefs is what we might broadly call society, right? So if the society we're in changes, we might find that a belief that we made that answered a question that was significant in the previous expression of that society is no longer relevant, or that the answer we've come up with no longer fits the society we're in. And this is one of the reasons why, if you have the privilege of travel, and you travel as opposed to going on vacation, right? Because we can go on vacation and not change anything culturally. We can just go to an all-inclusive resort that caters to our culture, and there we are in a different climate with our culture, which is very different from going, I'm going to engage with where I am, right? But if we go and engage with where we are when we travel, one of the things we encounter is stories about how the world works that are different than our stories. And if we probe that a little more deeply, almost always, we find that those stories make sense in that society. Right? That they've been working with their raw materials, just like we've been working with our raw materials, and what they made is different than what we made. And so social influence, that's more what I mean by social influence there. What's our deeper, wider social confluence when we're making beliefs? And let me just a quick diversion here to give words to something that maybe we're all assuming, but maybe we're not. I'm assuming that beliefs are something we make. And I'm using that language consistently. That's what I believe about beliefs. Not everybody does. There are certainly lots of people who believe that beliefs are something that are given to us by somebody outside of us. And lots of religious frameworks work this way. What I believe isn't my belief, actually. It's what God says is true, and I just picked up the ball, right? So that's a different frame than I made this, and I can change it, right? They're sort of fundamentally different. This all works better if you believe that we make beliefs, right? If you have to hold that other sort of frame, some of the stuff is just like, what? That doesn't even make sense. And then emotional and value-based factors. So the way we feel about what we're experiencing can have a tremendous impact on what we believe. And really intriguing research, I won't get into the weeds on this, at least not deep into the weeds. I'll just get onto the soft shoulder and come back to the road. There's lots of research in the last 3-4 decades that says that what we experience impacts how we feel, all right, our emotions. The research that says that how we feel informs what we believe is relatively young. Probably the last 20 years or so that's research has more substance. But it's really starting to gain some ground. And when you say it fast, it sort of makes sense. If I have a strong feeling, that might inform what I believe. But we've done almost weaving sort of Eurocentric research writ large around mental health and emotional intelligence and fields like that. We really haven't done very much research about the flow in that direction until the last couple of decades. But that's starting to happen. And one of the things, and it doesn't feel like a surprise to me, but some of the researchers are like, is that if you have a strong emotion about something, it deeply informs your belief. And you might not have a strong emotion about an experience because of what you believe. So, for example, if we've been taught, and it's been hammered into us, that anger is wrong, let's just say, and you have an experience where what happens inside your neurobiology is the emotion of anger, when the emotion engine fires up, because it does that without permission, right? We don't need to be consciously involved in that. And our body gets fired up, and what we're experiencing is anger. But what our conscious mind, our cerebral cortex, is saying is, you're not allowed to feel that. It's bad and wrong. Complicated, right? That's the cognitive dissonance would be a phrase that captures that inside the discipline. But emotional and values-based factors can have a huge impact on what we believe and why we change our beliefs. So, powerful stuff. Now, what I wanted to get to today, and I will, is at least we'll start into a bit of consideration of how to change beliefs when you want to or think you might want to. How to explore that. I'm going to do this kind of as steps. They're not necessarily all tidy. I'm calling them steps, and that immediately evokes a take one, then take another, a really kind of linear progression. This might not be so tidy, but I think there is some linearity to some of these ideas, and so I'm going to present them that way with that caveat. Stop one is the biggie, honestly. Stop one is identify your beliefs. Another way to say the same thing here, be aware of your current beliefs and where they come from. If we're going to change beliefs and we're going to do it on purpose, we need to know what we believe. We need to know what we're changing. Now, there's lots of ways to change beliefs. On purpose is only one of them, right? We can default. We can defect. I don't have another D. Wouldn't that be tidy? Admit defeat. I'm reaching, right? There's lots of ways we can change beliefs, and being deliberate is only one of them. But if we're going to be deliberate about it, we need to know what we're changing. That's stop one. And for many of us, not an unusual story, for many of us, the beliefs we have, we inherited. That some of the core beliefs that we have are the ones that somebody handed us before we were thinking about this for ourselves, or really even felt like we had agency around this for ourselves. And some of those beliefs have deep, deep roots. They do not change easily, even when we become conscious of them and we start to examine them and think, that's not a healthy belief or a right belief or a belief that works for me anymore. So being aware of our current beliefs and where they come from is challenging enough, occupying enough, that it's not unusual for us to need some help with it. And that can be sort of the soft-sided but very real nature of conversations with friends, people we trust, family, loved ones, community, all of that. Sometimes this stuff goes deep enough and shakes us hard enough that what we really need is a skilled professional listener and care provider. Like we need somebody who can help us peel the onion a bit on some of these. Some of the stuff can run really deep. I was reminded of the weight of this last week, I think is when I heard this, CBC Ideas show on Simone Weil's work. Simone Weil, a French philosopher and a mystic, somebody who died very young, but whose work just keeps on speaking, which is fascinating in itself, in the contemporary realm. Weil argued that paying attention, like just really paying attention to something, was the means of opening the mind to what she called eternal wisdom. That there is no substitute for paying attention. Weil also believed that many of the structures that are supposed to help us do this don't. That they actually get in the way. And so despite the fact that she had, I think, depending how you're counting, 3 or 4 distinct mystical experiences that deeply informed her own spirituality, and that the context for, if not all of those, then 3 of the 4, was a Christian religious architectural setting, at least, was in a church, she wasn't a huge fan of organized religion. And she argued that organized religion is pragmatic in a way, and this is her imagery, that makes it function like a pharmaceutical advertisement in that it's only valuable for what it promises to deliver. When you come into this shop, you get this, period. For a mystic, that's just like, that's terrible. It doesn't mean the thing that's on offer doesn't have value. It just means that that's where it stops. What comes to mind is somebody sort of steeped in Christian teaching and educated in that realm. For me, what comes to mind is actually Jesus' teaching on public prayer, which is really both an interesting teaching about that realm of our lived experience, but also a really rich metaphor for this value. And basically the context for that, the particular story text that I'm thinking of is people sort of going, well, look at these really religious folks. Like they're praying right out there on the street corner. Isn't that kind of a big deal? And Jesus is like, well, depends how you look at it and why you're doing it. If you're doing it so other people will notice that you're doing it, and they notice and go, aren't you spiritual? You just got your reward. Period. That's the whole story, right? And I think that lots of religious things are like that. If we come to religion looking for what that religion says they have on offer, and we get that, period. Is that a bad thing? Not necessarily. Is it the whole thing? I don't think it comes even close, personally. But for many people, it's enough of the thing. And they'd be like, good, I got what I came for. That's not the person that this talkie bit is for. All right? That's not a bad person. That's not a judgment or dismissal. It's just a particularity. That's not a person who's like, I wonder how I could change what I believe. I came for this. I got this. Good. I spent lots of years in organized religion in my career. And I could tell you lots of stories about asking people, why do you go to this church or that church? And they're like, because the band kicks ass. You know, or words to that effect. And I'm like, that's nice. You know, I like the light show. Yeah, the smoke machine, yeah. There's one in the back, just so you all know. If that's what you're looking for, never mind. We can make that happen for you. Yeah. And it's vegetable-based smoke. Like, it'll be fine. Anyway, we get what we came for from Vale's perspective as well. And I think that's really interesting. There's pragmatic limits. All to say, teasing out what we truly believe from the stuff that surrounds it, including the stuff that surrounds it internally, not just the stuff that surrounds it externally, and for some of us has surrounded it from the very first moments we were exposed to articulated or enacted beliefs. Teasing those things apart can be just really ripping hard to do. And it can take a long time. So it's a bit of an aside in terms of my outline, as far as that goes, in terms of where I was headed, but I would want to add this. I think when it comes to exploring what we believe and deliberately considering changing something that we believe, there's a couple things that I think are really important as wider values. One is patience. This is stuff to be careful with because the bits are so interconnected. This is a little bit, and I'll push the metaphor maybe a little bit, but if this was something that needed, that was internal for us physically and that needed to be removed because it was potentially harmful or it could become toxic, this is not the sort of thing where you go after it with a skill saw and a pair of bolt cutters. This is some of this stuff is so intertwined that if we start fiddling with it, it's going to pull on other things that are really important that need to be kept well in the process. And so being patient and getting skillful help and support and gaining skill ourselves, if this is a DIY project, those are all really important components of changing what you believe. So patience is one part, and kindness is another. And I would start with kindness to the self. Be kind to yourself. The story that was shared in our community time about somebody kind of going, is this just all in my head? These experiences I'm having with my body, is this, am I a hypochondriac? And can I just put big air quotes around just in my head, please? Because in our head is a real place. Those are real experiences and not to be dismissed. But we do that, right? We wonder, like, is this legit? Am I making this up? I use the word advisedly, am I crazy to feel this or think this or to consider this? Kindness to the self, all to say, and kindness to one another, to other people who are having these experiences. This is not easy stuff. And then to top all of that up, and we're still just on identify your beliefs, to top all of that off, what we believe can easily be a moving target, because just the fact that we're talking about changing your beliefs on purpose, I hope, illustrates that beliefs are changeable. Right? Maybe that's a given. But for many of us, we grew up in places where that's not what we were taught. At least we were taught that right beliefs either are not changeable or should not be changed. Right? Which, pretty close relationship between those. That's only one right path, right? Yeah, if you get off it, you're headed for the ditch. So that stuff runs deep. Right? And so we got to be cognizant of that. And that what I mean when I say beliefs can be a moving target is that I shouldn't speak for all of us, but most of us as human beings, we hold beliefs that we don't know we hold. And one of the ways we discover that we hold them sometimes is when they're challenged. When something pops up, a social change, an environmental change, an experiential change, one of those things we talked about in our little review earlier, smacks into our life and we're like, oh, beep, beep, beep. These things will not fit with one another. Now what do I do, right? And especially if we were trained to believe that there's only one right belief system, because then the question that immediately follows is, which of these is right? Not necessarily a helpful question. But if our big core frame of reference is there's right belief and wrong belief, and there's nothing in the middle, they're all binaries, then as soon as we have some cognitive dissonance, we feel like we have choice A and choice B, and that's it. But if we actually zoom out on our lived experience a bit, one of the things most of us will discover is we've been living our whole lives with a whole bunch of beliefs that are floating around semi-loose. And they behave this way in that context, and they behave this way in this other context. All to say, identifying our beliefs can be really tricky for lots of reasons, and that's one of them. Our beliefs can be a moving target. They can be quite contextual. And then, of course, we were taught that we shouldn't do that with our beliefs, but we discover that we are doing that with the beliefs. Now we have to deal with our guilt and our shame and all of our, you know, all of that good stuff. So, stop one, identifying our beliefs. And with that in mind, with the magnitude and the challenge of that stop in mind, what I want to do is offer a couple of sort of rather practical suggestions about how we can practices, how we can more deliberately explore what we believe. And the first stop on that particular journey is noticing our thoughts, which might sound like an odd thing to say. Many of us, I would say that it's normal, if we're defining normal by majority experience, this is not a thing that most of us have done. We all have what could be reasonably called automatic thoughts, the things that just pop into our head unbidden. Lots of ways to think about this. Maybe a broad strokes way to think about it is conscious and unconscious thought. We have lots of thoughts that we don't think about, right? We don't bring them up to the front office and have a conversation with them. They happen in the back room of our subconscious. In fact, most of our thoughts, by definition, happen there. So what I'm talking about when I talk about noticing thoughts is I'm talking about starting to attend to what the things are that we think without thinking about them and starting to think about them. That's a practice. It doesn't happen by default, and it doesn't happen accidentally. It requires actual engagement. Automatic thoughts are the thoughts that we don't notice but that occur in response to everyday events. And they are the thoughts that our subconscious is using to help us make sense of what we're experiencing and what's happening to us. And by becoming aware of them, we can start to notice if there are consistent themes or patterns in what we think, what we automatically think. So I am, if you haven't noticed, I'll make it explicit, I am conflating think and believe here. All right? Our automatic thoughts govern, unless we make them conscious and change them, they govern our behavior because they're what we believe what we're experiencing means. And what we believe about what we're experiencing in terms of meaning, that's what guides our actions. We act according to what we believe. Right? So that's the sequence. Stimulus, belief, action. Event, belief, action. So, belief is the category we have access to. We don't have necessarily agency about what happens to or around us. And our actions are a result of our beliefs. So arguably, in some ways, that's not where the agency lies either. The agency lies in the realm of belief. And so when we're starting to notice what we automatically do or what we automatically think is the case when something happens, oh, that must mean this, and so I'm going to act this way. When we start to pay attention to those things and we do it over time, we can start to see patterns. And when we start to see patterns, we're starting to actually see what we believe. We're starting to put edges around what we believe. It's a bit of a process, all right? What we're looking for is consistency. Noticing is all fine and good. That still can be pretty much internal. It can all kind of happen in our head. So, second step, and I know this is a bumper sticker trope already, but so help me, this is what we got to do if we actually want to do the work. Like, write it down. Dear diary. Yeah. Yes.
I would suggest on paper.
Yes, I would too. It's a different, and why would you suggest that, Jane? I'm curious.
It's a different, it's a very, very different experience.
And how do you experience that as different? I agree with you 100%. I'm curious to know what.
It is, like, digital feels like a lot easy.
when you're like actually writing it on a piece of paper, it feels real and tangible and like, I don't know. And then there's like also no mistakenly putting it onto your work file.
You don't hit send on the wrong thing. Yeah. Yes, there's also that. Yes.
It also sometimes serendipitously arrives back. Like you were looking for something, you find an old journal,
or
you find it in your pants pocket.
Yes, so there's always notebook. Exactly. Yeah, 100%.
There was a list of boys.
Sorry, what did you say, Sarah?
She has at least 10 to 15 notebooks.
Yes.
Or like random and scattered.
What do you think about
your formative years? That's when you were writing things on paper. Those are the things that formed you. Right? Like, so I wonder if there is some like connection to that. Making something real,
yeah.
Letting it take up space in your space.
Yes. Like 20 years from now, we look back into our digital files to see what.
You know, yes. And there's also, intriguingly, there's all of that, and there's also some really well-established brain science around this. When we do things with our hands, the bits of our brain talk to one another much more lively way. When we actually involve our bodies. We don't just have bodies, we are bodies. And so doing a thing with our bodies that's about trying to know what's going on in our mind actually makes a lot of sense. And the other thing that happens with our ideas when we externalize them is we reify them, right? We turn a thought into a thing. Fancy word for ordinary process, right? And when we turn a thought into a thing, now we can circle it. Like, literally, I'm not talking about draw a circle around it. Of course, we can do that. I'm using a metaphor here. But now we can walk around it and look at it from different angles. We can examine it. And if we're talking about consciously changing our beliefs, that's exactly what we want to be able to do with a belief. We want to be able to take it out of our head and put it in the middle of the table and walk around and look at it from the back, right? And go, oh, that's what that looks like from over there. That's what that might look like to somebody else. That's what that looked like to my mother who taught it to me. But I'm not my mother, am I? And it doesn't look that way to me. So externalization, reification was the word, thingification was the word that I used for it, is a really important part of this process. And this is what I already just described. I'm on main point one, sub point two. There's so much, that's for, that's 2 months from now at this rate. All to say, this is so much work, right? So, Jason, you said this a couple of weeks ago when we were kind of heading down this path, you just sort of piped up where you were sitting and you said, not everybody wants this, which is where the title came from, right? Yeah, not everybody wants this. And I would argue, disagree, please, but think for yourself, I would argue that in terms of lived experience, not everybody needs this, which is a really tricky idea for me because I value this so deeply that I'm like, of course everybody needs this. Think for yourself if you want to be fully human. Like, but that's my lens on it, right? Not everybody needs this. And not everybody needs this in their religious experience. For lots of people, what they come to religion for is community and comfort and stability. This is what I'm describing here is a deeply destabilizing set of ideas. And I'm cognizant of that, and I don't want to be blithe about it. Having said that, I would tilt towards Simone Veil's conviction that there isn't another way if we want to actually engage with mystery. I don't think we can do it without actually thinking. Now, that's both a wonderful thought and a terrible thought, because what if you can't? What if you can't think the way I think thinking works? Do you still qualify for engagement with mystery? Not even my call, right? Like, now I'm really out of my lane, even as a human, never mind as a particular person. I leave that to the mystery.
The question I think that underlies that is, so what? Do you know what I mean? Like, there's a bit of, like, you say, well, if you can't engage with mystery, if you can't do this, you can't engage with mystery, right? And so to me, that, like, brings back the idea of, like, well, there's a right way to do things.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
That's probably what I'm trying to challenge, is my own internal notion of that.
Yeah. I think that's what you're saying. I think there's something encouraging in that. It's like, so people, it's like, go to church on Sunday, go through your mass, come here, whatever, And that's great. And you feel great for a week. And it's like, that's all you do in life? And I come from a place where I was like, no, you can't believe that's all you do in life, right? But now I'm kind of where I'm like, it's like, I'm happy for you. Like,
yes.
You don't have to be in the shit all the time.
Yeah.
Metaphorically. Of this kind of existential crisis.
Yeah.
So, anyway, I didn't want to.
No, an existential crisis is enervating for some of us and not for others, as well, right? And that's so. And part of me would say to the, of the type you just described, that's quite lovely, as well. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like if that's where the period on your lived experience sentence is.
As long as it doesn't turn into hate and and bigotry and stuff like that, I think that's great.
Yeah. And I mean, exploring what you believe can turn into hate and bigotry just as well as not exploring it, right? Like we can twist anything into that space. Yeah, I agree. No apology, Tim.
But also, like, religion can, I think it's a recognition that religion can fill a very legitimate human need and does so in a pretty efficient way.
Yes.
For a lot of us.
Really effective.
Community, ritual.
Mm-hmm.
Connection to the transcendent and something that's beyond ourselves, right? These are all valuable things.
Yeah.
It's just a great, for some people, it's just like, perfect, that's a great formula for me, and I'll just plug myself into it and do the rituals and go to church on Sunday. It's perfect.
One of the trends that fascinates me right at the moment is that emerging generations sort of the age of our adult kids and a little bit younger than that, statistically are returning to fundamentalist belief shapes in statistically noteworthy numbers. And I look around at the world and it's the way sort of destabilization is reaching this continent in a way that's kind of really hasn't happened since the Second World War. There's war in Europe again, which does feel like it's on the doorstep in a different way, culturally and geographically. I think about just that in terms of destabilizing. And I'm like, shouldn't be a surprise. Because that's powerful stuff.
Yes,
right?
Especially among young men.
Yes.
Which is also, that's a whole different...
Yeah, it is. And it has a particular valence in many ways that is also distressing. And to circle back, that points towards its loneliness that gets you in the end, in a lot of ways, right? To the need for community and connection. This is a fundamental human need. Keeping a diary was where we were. The good news is I have notes, and I have a watch, and it says that we're all but out of time. So I know how to make marks in my notes and say we'll pick this up again, and that's what I'm going to do. One of the reasons these things sprawl in this setting is me and my proclivities. I appreciate that that's true, and I acknowledge it, and I own it. And the other reason is you and these conversations we keep having.
Blaming us.
I love this. I am not trying to absolve myself in any way. I am. I think he's thanking us. If you have to wonder, I should say it again. Thank you.
We're sort of willing victims.
Yeah, you showed up and you knew what the topic was. I love that this is what happens. And I'm not sure I like your metaphor on that one, Lisa, but sure, I can go with that. Anyway, I think it's lovely, and I'm so grateful to be part of the conversation, and I'm grateful to have the opportunity to be an instigator and to stir the pot. I'm going to leave the talky bit there for today and say peace and keep exploring.